Everyday People is a podcast showcasing seemingly unextraordinary people's beliefs, experiences, history, and outlook. It is a space to share oneself unapologetically and portray the otherwise insignificant everyday person in a more interesting and dynamic light. This podcast's purpose is to emphasize the extraordinary in the otherwise insignificant, and to portray humanity's overlooked normal public as far more engaging and interesting. The beliefs and opinions of the guests do not necessarily reflect those of the Everyday People staff. Rather, we believe in diving deep within people's understanding and thoughts of the world, whether we agree or not. Provoking questions may be asked, but this is not a debate show. We invite our listeners to let go of any preconceived notions and take the guests' ideas on their own terms. Welcome to the Everyday People podcast. Today I have with me a Christian conservative and apologist. Thank you for coming to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
We talked a little bit just earlier starting that you're a conservative Christian. Could you kind of describe what that means and what are the foundations of both and how are they related if you find them fundamentally related in any way?
Yeah, so I would say that I'm a Christian and I'm a follower of Jesus Christ. And I do that in a way that's traditional, seen as Christianity over the last 2,000 years. I'm not a Catholic or an Orthodox Christian, but I do believe that I'm holding to the faith that is going back to the original. So I'm trying to conserve or hold on to that which was original to the Christian faith. Politically, the term conservative changes over time. Generally speaking, when I use it, I would say that I am trying to conserve part of the original American dream, that there was claims about individual rights that are really important. I think of the phrase from the Declaration of Independence: all men are created equal and are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. And among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So politically speaking, I want to conserve that ideology from early America. Obviously, the man who penned that held slaves. In early America, that ideology was on paper and not, or very often was not, reality. But I do want to conserve that ideology and want that going forward.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's a pretty good summation of what I think a lot of strict conservatives really want to do. I mean, I look at conservatism as pretty much the upholding of traditional values in the political sphere and within this country and within the West in general. The idea of individual rights that are inalienable is definitely a crucial crux to the sociopolitical structure.
I would say conservatism, it's got, I'll say, two main wings. You would have what I would profess more of a deontic human rights, a libertarianism, and then more of, then there's a right wing, maybe what you think of as maybe more pro-nationalist, right-wing republicanism. And those are both get lumped under the term conservatism. And a lot of people hold a little bit of both. And I tend strongly towards the libertarian part of that spectrum.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting development. I think really since probably Reagan, who spoke briefly, but a few times about the term libertarian, ever since then, it's kind of been growing a little bit. I mean, Reagan was before my time, but I personally was, you know, involved a lot in libertarianism kind of in my late teens, early 20s. And it's an interesting faction of kind of the conservative political movement. Now, do you view your interest in politics and your interest in religion as kind of intertwined, or are these two separate things? Or did one lead you to the other, or are these two kind of separate magisteria in general?
No, I would say that they're the same for me.
Okay.
I can subcategories, philosophy, theology, and political theory to make conversation easier. But honestly, they're all part of my ethical philosophy, and I can't really see any of them existing apart from the others.
So do you have any history where you kind of deviated from either? I mean, I guess if you deviate from one, the way you say they're very closely kind of tied in, basically the same thing, you would have to deviate from the other. Were there times that you kind of, you know, were in a different theater, whether spiritually or politically, or has this kind of consistently been a life reaffirming thing as you've aged? I don't know how old you are, but I assume you're at least in your 20s, if not older. So has this been a consistent thing, or have you delved into other ideologies at all?
So I've been raised in a conservative Christian home. For most people, secularists, they would say that my family is very conservative.
Okay.
But being where I am, I always know people a lot more conservative than myself and a lot less conservative than myself. And so I would say I grew up more as a moderate, but now as I've met more people, I realized that I'd be labeled pretty extreme on the conservative label. My parents aren't that politically active, and I would say that they're right in the middle in terms of that right-wing republicanism and libertarianism. So I would say that I have definitely gravitated towards libertarianism, I'd say, in the last 7 or 8 years. And it really seems like, like so many people, I hold similar beliefs to my parents, but I've been more committed to philosophical purity, or what turns out to be radicalism, perhaps, that it seemed like there was a lot of good in my upbringing, but there were some beliefs that contradicted one another, and it's been more important to me to get to the bottom on certain issues and to throw out things that conflicted. And in doing so, I've thrown out a lot of the right-wing republicanism in favor of the libertarian ideology, where they conflicted. So that has been a change over time.
What ideas of, you know, republicanism have you kind of let go of in favor of libertarianism? Things like, obviously, libertarians are more libertine on things like drugs, or things like immigration sometimes, or things like same-sex marriage, or what specifically have you gravitated away from?
Yeah, so I would say it started with prohibition.
Okay.
My household's a teetotaling household. I grew up that way, and I've continued that way. But even so, it's kind of, nobody's pro-prohibition these days. But
sure,
I would have been slightly so growing up, would have considered prohibition as a good thing. Then I really was challenged, well, what do you believe about liberty and all this other thing? It doesn't fit with your whole ideology. It was through friendly conversation, debate, that I realized, wow, you know, I'm really being inconsistent if I want the government to take away alcohol, but I think it's, all these other things are none of the government's business. So that would be a hinge point for me. But then once that's gone, then the war on drugs looks terrible. So I just give you a little bit more of my family history. I'm a son of a pastor.
Okay.
In the Church of Nazarene, and my grandfather was a pastor in the Church of Nazarene. My grandfather, now this is my mother's father. She has three brothers. Two of them are policemen, and one of them is kind of libertarian, lives in the woods by himself, lots of guns. And,
sounds like a libertarian to me.
Yeah. I have the full gamut of conservatism in my family.
Sure.
I have the radical libertarian. I have the Trump supporter, right wingers, and it's kind of I see the full spectrum of what people call conservatism in my family. So it's kind of funny. I think it's humorous. I got good pictures of the different views out there.
Sure.
I definitely found that after thinking through what I really believed about prohibition, that the war on drugs had to fall pretty quickly then. And then I started questioning more about wars, reading history. I enjoy history. I enjoy, like most boys, I enjoy the history of wars, reading about battles, and that was true growing up. And so you start realizing, okay, basically every government in history has been corrupt. But not America, of course, not America. That's kind of how I was as a teenager. I mean, I wasn't, that's kind of what I would have thought. I wasn't politically involved, so I wasn't having a lot of conversations about it, but I would say that was basically my understanding as a teenager. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But they were really corrupt about slavery. But that's it. Everything else is probably perfect.
Sure.
Maybe killing Indians and taking their land wasn't so good either. Okay. Well, all right. So they're perfect except for those. And then, okay. So we started a war in Panama because Roosevelt wanted to build a canal. Okay. Well, maybe that wasn't so good. And you just start reading dirty secrets of everybody. You find out Abraham Lincoln wasn't exactly the beacon of light that I thought he was. Not that he was all bad, but you read Frederick Douglass and what he had to say, and you start to realize, maybe power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. That's maybe a better view of reality than most of the nationalist type views that are going around.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty common journey for a lot of people, especially in, again, I'm assuming your age, and I'm not asking, but I feel like we're probably both millennials, so we're close to it.
Yeah. And,
we're from the same generation, so I feel like that's been a big thing. Like, you don't really see many, and maybe you have more exposure to this than I do, but you really don't see many traditional conservatives, that are millennials and younger. You really don't see that. You see a lot of more libertarian type individuals on the conservative or right wing of the political spectrum. And
it seems like the people my age who care have moved more libertarian.
Sure. Yeah, it's been interesting. I remember when Ron Paul was the biggest thing in conservatism, that was, for some reason, he just wasn't getting the necessary political attention. And I was just enthralled by this guy. I thought he was the coolest dude ever. My politics changed shortly thereafter. But it is interesting that, a lot of people, younger people, I would say probably under 45 or so, have really leaned more towards, libertarianism than anything. What about religion? Have you deviated at all? You said you were part of the Church of Nazarene. Have you deviated at all in your faith or your understanding? And how has, I've seen you're at least somewhat interested in apologetics. How has that kind of worked its way into your life?
Yeah. I'm still a member of the Church of the Nazarene, so in one sense, you'd say my faith hasn't deviated very much. Though it has changed a lot at times, gone through its ups and downs. So the Church of the Nazarene is typical evangelical church. We believe in the Bible, the 66 books of the Protestant Bible. We believe in that Jesus was born of a virgin. We believe in the miraculous accounts of the Bible that he died and was raised to life. Now, not all Nazarenes believe this, but I certainly grew up being taught young earth creationism, which is a view I still hold and a lot of people find ridiculous. But I would say, much like in my political journey that I was speaking of, I still hold the same religious principles that I found most important as a child, but I've had to get rid of some that conflicted with others. I can't really think of what a good example of that would be. I went to a Nazarene college, and I felt like the college was trying to drive me left in many ways, both politically and spiritually. And I kind of dug in my heels and fought back against that. And if anything, I became more religiously fundamentalist after college.
That's not a phrase many people utter.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it was, you know, I felt like they were trying to push me, and I saw most of my classmates, maybe all but a few, went radically left after college. And I felt the influence that way. I'm not saying that everyone at the college was trying to pull you to the left, but the persuasive voice in the end was leftward. But I kind of dug in, and I wasn't going to have any of that. Yeah, but I'll say 3 or 4 years afterwards, there are a lot of good objections to Christianity, at least to certain parts of fundamentalism that I grew up with. And it seems like there were some objections presented when I was in college, and then after the objections were presented, kind of pictures of leftist or progressive Christianity are slid in. And as I grew older, I realized, well, some of these objections were legitimate, and I really need to consider them. Now, the left progressive Christianity is a dumpster fire, and they were trying to substitute that for my fundamentalist Christianity. And I didn't feel like that was intelligent at all. But as I really do have to deal with the objections to my traditional fundamentalist Christianity that were presented. And so there are some areas that I've become less fundamentalist on. I am still a young earth creationist, but I'm more open to the possibility that maybe that's not how Genesis was intended to be read. I read early Christian authors, and I found that it was something like 80-20, 80% appear to be young earth creationists, and 20% of the early church said, oh, well, that's an allegory for a longer period of time. And so I felt like, okay, maybe I can give up young earth creationism and without abandoning the Bible, but I still don't feel like that's the right thing to do. I don't in that particular area feel like I'm going to make that change, but I'm more open to that being a possibility than I once was.
That's interesting. I think when particularly more secular people kind of look at the history of Christianity, they tend to view that up until now, basically all Christians were young earth creationists, whereas fundamentalism has a very obvious history, particularly like in the US, where, you know, in the early 1900s, fundamentalism really took off. But even as you said, you know, back in the, you know, the very early days of the church, there still were voices that viewed a lot of the Old Testament in particular as allegorical and, you know, not meant to be taken literally in the most strict sense, but, you know, to at least portray a very real message. So you're open, you said, to kind of thinking about your position of young earth creationism. What prompted that? And what do you think are some troubling things you kind of have to address?
Yeah. So I would say reading church history, apologetics, because I care very much about what I believe. I do want to defend the Christian faith and my political view, but I would say that I spend most of the time reading apologetics, not because I was attempting to defend the faith as much as I am attempting to learn more myself for my own personal advancement. I believe Christianity is true. If I stopped believing it was true, then I wouldn't want to be a Christian anymore. Because I'd say it's implied that the truth is morally valuable. That's a philosophical claim that basically everyone assumes, but isn't really spoken of about enough, that the truth actually matters. So I would say apologetics is, the search has been just as much personal as it has been trying to convince anybody else of anything.
Sure.
So I'm not terribly excited by the natural sciences. So I'm not someone who studies all the arguments for evolution or all the arguments against young earth creationism.
Okay.
Some of the ones that make the most sense to me is, right off the bat, is, well, on young earth creationism, where the dinosaurs fit in, how does that work? And there are answers to that. It does. They would say, so a lot of young earth creationists believe that there was no animal death before the fall. Now, in Christian understanding, particularly fundamentalist Christian understanding, the fall was an event that took place about 6,400 years ago, that the earth was created in a 7-day period about 6,400 years ago. And at that time, it was created without evil in it. And so many young earth creationists believe that there were no carnivores at that time. And then some period pretty soon afterwards, no specifics are given, might have been a month after creation, 3 years after creation, we don't really know. And the Bible doesn't make any claims that way, that Adam and Eve sinned, and with the sin of Adam and Eve, the earth, all of natural creation suffered, things began to fall apart, disease entered the world, death entered the world. And so some people believe that there were no carnivores before the fall. And so looking at, okay, so some people think that there were T-Rexes that ate plants before the fall, or that sharks were eating seaweed. And that seems pretty hard to swallow when you look at their
teeth.
That sort of thing. So that would be one strong objection to young earth creationism that I've encountered.
Interesting. I mean, yeah, I had to kind of hold back a little snivel when I heard you say that there might be some people that believe that, you know, sharks ate seaweed and T-Rex ate plants. It does strike me as kind of ridiculous. That's really the only word I can use for it. But I mean, I'm open to hearing from an individual who believes this and their justifications. But so you kind of talk about young earth creationism as a real, thorn in your side about kind of reckoning with your faith. Have you found anything else? I mean, I know a lot of particularly Protestants kind of deal with the issue of predestination a lot. Where do you fall on that?
Yeah, so that's a good topic. So the Church of the Nazarene is a Wesleyan Arminian denomination, which is not a Calvinist denomination. Calvinism as a branch of Protestantism is pretty big and pretty vocal. And so that gets a lot of attention. Wesleyan Arminians, we don't believe that that humans are predestined to heaven or hell before time began. We believe in free will. We believe in libertarian free will.
Okay.
And we believe that the way of salvation is open to all men who choose to respond to the call of God, and that God gives the ability to respond to all human beings. So that's not as hard, not very hard for my denomination, where it might be for a lot of other denominations.
Yeah, I mean, particularly for me, the difficulty when I was raised kind of in the Lutheran tradition, and Luther and Calvin are kind of pinned against each other in a lot of very surface level historical lenses, I should say. And the thing, and it's always revolving around predestination, but the interesting thing is they were both really on the same page as far as if predestination was a thing or not. It was just where to go once, you know, when we want to talk about the consequences for predestination. And I, like I said, I found that particularly for Protestants to be a big thing that drove a lot of people away or drove people into kind of different denominations of Christianity, because it doesn't seem logical, or maybe I shouldn't use the phrase logical, but it strikes us as wrong that it strikes us as wrong that God would put some of us here simply to live this mortal life and then to suffer indefinitely through, you know, no choice of our own. And that kind of brings me into another kind of thorn in a lot of people's side, which is the problem of evil, which is kind of adjacently related. As far as your faith is concerned, how do you view the problem of evil, that being that evil exists, and how do you define that, and how do you co-opt that into your faith to say it's non-contradictory with like an omniscient and omnipresent being? Not to kind of assume that it's necessarily a problem for everybody, but I guess I'm just asking, how do you approach it, and has it been a difficulty for you?
So maybe I'll backtrack a little bit and give you my main arguments for the existence of God, and then how the problem of evil kind of fits into those, if that's okay.
Yeah, no, that would be great.
I would say that arguments for the existence of God are important to me, philosophical arguments. And the two primary ones that I look at would be the cosmological argument and then the moral argument, or more specifically, the argument for moral knowledge, and that those are really cornerstones of my faith.
Okay.
Now, some people think maybe overplay the cosmological argument as far as I'm concerned.
Are you referring to the one that is popularized by Kalam and then repopularized by William Lane Craig?
Yes. So that's a fine version. There's a lot out there that it's the same basic idea.
Okay. The whatever began to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist, therefore the universe had a cause. And I know there are many more sophisticated versions of this which directly imply God rather than simply a cause, but that basic one.
Yes. And okay. I wouldn't write it that far. You know, I would say the cosmological argument tells us that something is eternal.
Okay.
And that's pretty small, you know, compared to what a lot of people think that proves. I consider that cosmological argument shows that there must be something which is eternal.
Okay.
Some people say, okay, well, I'm okay with that. It's just got to be the universe.
Sure.
And as far as the cosmological argument goes, I'm okay with that. If you just want to say, all right, well, it's the universe that's eternal, then I'm okay with that from the cosmological standpoint. But okay. I do think it's significant to admit that there's something that is eternal as opposed to infinite regression. I think that that's an important piece of knowledge. So I would say that's important to me. But the most important would be the argument for moral knowledge. And I actually have knowledge that morality exists. And what is morality? Well, I would say that morality is this knowledge that there's a way that things are supposed to be. There are things that are not good, which means there are things that are counter to the way that things are supposed to be. If this is really true, then we'll say that existence has a purpose, that there really is valuation and purpose is a part of existence, and it's inherent to existence. And so to have a purpose, I think that a purpose requires a proposer. There has to be a mind behind purpose and a mind behind value. And so I believe that we know that there is a mind behind existence, that existence has its own sort of goals or purpose, that there is some sort of mind behind existence. Some philosophers have called this a world soul. Obviously, Christians are going to call it God. Mm-hmm. But I think the argument from moral knowledge shows that there is, in some sense, a mind. Now, maybe this mind is incapable of gathering new information or viewing the world. But there is a mind that gives purpose to existence. So from my standpoint, cornerstone of my faith is believing that there is an eternal mind that gives purpose to existence, or rather there is an eternal mind which is ontologically tied to existence. That's a cornerstone of my faith. Now, some people would just call that deism, which I'm okay with. The belief that there is sort of got some real crucial attributes of the deity in this world soul. Does this world soul or God have any power today? And that's where the problem of evil comes in that Christianity teaches that this world soul not only gives purpose to existence, but is actively working and has power today. And I think that the problem of evil, its strong suit is not towards atheism, but is towards deism. That is to say perhaps this world soul doesn't have the power to make evil go away or make good happen, but all it can do is tell us its will or give us its will through the conscience.
Yeah, I always find it kind of frustrating when I hear atheists use the problem of evil argument to kind of state atheism as a positive claim. So they'll bring up the idea that evil exists and they don't think it's compatible with a God existing. But it's very frustrating that really they're arguing against attributes of God rather than they are a God's existence in and of itself. Yeah. So now if you give me like a particular thing, I can argue against attributes against a thing, but you know, just because I say that ball is not red, I'm not saying that ball doesn't exist. However, I am curious how in your worldview evil is allowed to exist, being that I know you understand that God exists and has a purpose, and that purpose, you know, kind of prescripts what is the right way to live. How do you kind of view people that are living in the wrong way or acting evil? Why does God allow this? And is it just because he needs to give us free will, or is there kind of a more sophisticated take on it?
I would hold to a free will theodicy, I could make it more sophisticated in saying that.
Sure.
I believe that God created us in his own image, and we find in Genesis a God who creates, and And so when God makes us in his own image, he's created humanity with the ability to create, to make things. One of them is to make decisions. Well, creation involves making decisions. It involves freedom. And so that God created the world with, and he created human beings with the power to create. And with this power came the power to do evil. There also came the potential to experience love and to really to experience existence in a meaningful way. That free will is actually a good thing, and it's necessary for a lot of the goods that we see in this world. And a lot of what it means to be in the image of God is to exercise free will and to have free will.
Continue.
So there's different takes on free will. Obviously, I go to the Church of the Nazarene, and it teaches a Wesleyan Arminian view of divine foreknowledge, which would say that God knew the evil that we were going to do, and yet he created us anyway. So then you would have to have this weight of, okay, well, the good of free will existing has to outweigh then the bad of the evil decisions that are made. But more and more, I'm moving away from that view to what's called open theism. And open theism is the view that God created human beings in such a way that they are free, and that this freedom entails the ability to do something different, and the ability to do something other, or the ability to do something different entails that the future is open, which would mean that divine foreknowledge is not possible on areas that are truly on the basis of free will.
So how do you square that with omniscience? If there isn't divine foreknowledge, how is God omniscient?
Yeah, so omniscience, I would say that God knows everything that is knowable. But most Christians would agree that God doesn't know what a square circle smells like, or what the square root of a pancake is. Yeah. There's incoherent and illogical phrases that can't be, that are logically contradictory to claim knowledge over.
Okay.
And the claim, and now most if not all open theists see God as acting in time as opposed to being a timeless entity. And so they would say that, and I would say that it's logically impossible for God to know a free will action ahead of time, because it's not decided until the time that it's committed.
I guess that's kind of that's a common objection to another objection from an atheist who would say, you've probably heard this before, can God create a rock so heavy that he cannot lift it? The question implies a illogical foundation.
Yes.
So that's interesting. Actually, I haven't really heard this description of what did you call it? Open theism, where divine foreknowledge is not a thing. Yeah, I haven't quite heard it described like that, where the future would be something that knowing the future in general is kind of an illogical thing, because God exists within time, or at least acts within time. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yep, that would be correct. Now, open theists, including me, there's some debate on how much is actually involved with free will, and there could be a lot of future events that are already decided by nature or things like that, and God would have absolute knowledge over those things. And then he could make very good probability calculations based on free will actions as well. But yes, I don't believe in the exhaustive divine foreknowledge.
So it's basically God has some understanding of physical forces and the likelihood that some things will take place, which includes action by individuals who have free will. But those specific decisions would be unknowable given that God exists within time, or at least acts within time.
Yes.
That's interesting. I do want to go back where you were talking about the idea that individuals having free will is inherently more valuable than the downfall, which would be the existence of evil. So humans having free will is more important than eliminating evil. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah. So there are some open theists who would say that God did not know that evil was going to exist at all. But it was a risk worth taking by God's perspective. And I would say I tend towards that view. If you look in the book of Genesis, I believe it's chapter 6, it's the story of the flood. And God says, I am grieved. I am sorry that I made mankind. There's different denominations, different theological takes on that verse. But the open theist looks at that and says, you know, that God took a risk in creating human beings, and he's sorry that he took the risk.
But overall, I think it logically follows that that risk was warranted.
Yes.
Okay. But God can still be kind of grief-stricken over the consequences of his actions?
Yes.
Okay. Interesting, because I've kind of delved down this path as well, that, you know, when I've brought up in debates or discussions the problem of evil, which I find to be a pretty striking blow against the Christian God, or a God who is described as all-loving, all-knowing, all-powerful, etc., you know, I'm often told that, you know, free will is vitally important, that if we didn't have free will, God didn't truly love us. And it logically follows that having free will is a greater value than evil existing is a negative value. So, you know, it's like adding 100 and subtracting 90, you know, you're still positive.
You're still positive.
Do you, and you believe that, correct? Like, you think all the evil that exists in the world, it would be worse if evil didn't exist, but we had some level of control where we couldn't act out that evil, that this is a preferable system?
I would say that no, I'm not committed to that view.
Okay.
In fact, I tend towards the other, which says that God was grieved that he made mankind, and we should be too. And that is to say that it was not a net positive.
Really?
But if evil had not existed, it was its value is indescribable. Of a free will human that is not evil. Its value is, I don't know if infinite is the right term, but very high. I actually tend towards the view that God's grief there is ultimate, or a declaration that, that it would be better that it had not happened.
Do you think God could have created us in a way that, like, we, like you said, that God cannot tell you the scent of a square circle. Do you think it would have been possible for God to create us in a way such that capacity for evil is that logically difficult, or at least would be, our minds would be limited in such a way that we'd be unable to act it out? And I'll give you an example. The number, like, 20 billion. We have an understanding of what that is, right? Like, we know how many decimal places. We understand that, you know, it's some magnitude of the number 10. You know, we can calculate it and we can use it, but we can't actually picture it. So if somebody asks you to view, you know, imagine 5 tennis balls, most people can do that. There are some individuals who might kind of struggle with numbers or objects or something, but most people can imagine 5 tennis balls. Now you ask somebody, okay, imagine 100. Now that's very difficult to actually be able to put that picture in your mind and get a workable understanding of that number. But 20 billion would be impossible for, I'm not saying no human can do it, because I guess I don't actually know that, but it would seem that there is a value to which humans are unable to comprehend as far as like making abstractions within their head. Is it possible that God could have made us in a way where evil would be in that realm of just, we just simply can't fathom it? And if so, would that not be preferable to the free will model where we're able to act out evil? Or is the ability to act out evil and refrain from doing it an opportunity to, I don't know, maybe show God love, or maybe it's a higher moral value to be able to act out evil and not do it than not do it, but you're just not doing it because you don't have the availability to it, to do it. Sorry, that was a very long and loaded question, but
yeah.
What's your take on kind of those ideas?
There's a lot there. I'm not sure I can really answer that, but here's some thoughts that came with it when you're speaking. So I think that evil, I don't believe that evil has ontology of its own. Evil is always the perversion of a good. I believe that goodness exists, and then evil has to piggyback off of goodness, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Now, C.S. Lewis talks about this, and there are many others that do as well. For a free will individual, I'll back up. So God, being omniscient, always knows what's good. And so he's never going to choose a lesser good and put it above another. And that's ultimately what evil is. It's a misvaluation of reality. You know, you might say, sure, eating a candy bar is good. Stealing my friend's candy bar is bad. And that's because it would be, even though that eating a candy bar is good, my friend keeping his own property is a higher good than my candy bar. Stealing results when I put a lesser good above a greater good. So an omniscient being like God doesn't ever have that problem, because he has ultimate knowledge of goodness at all times. Now, a human being, unless God created us omniscient, is not going to have that knowledge, that perfect knowledge. So in order for a human being to do what is good, it's going to have to trust a moral agent, an omniscient moral agent, to help them know what good is. I would say that love could be defined as choosing the good, and that love exists as a free will choice to choose the good, to trust in the goodness of God. And so when God creates free will, and free will is necessary for a lot of things, but that there is actually a very important good that exists when a human being trusts in God, when he trusts the goodness of God. So people can give a number of scenarios where it's like, the question is like, is one drop of trust sufficient? So couldn't have God created a world where there was that evil was less likely? And wouldn't that have the same kind of value as this world? And I would say I have a difficulty answering that question. I don't really know exactly. I don't have a theory on how much free will is necessary for the beauty of love to exist. I'm not really sure about that. Maybe it's conceivable that God could have lessened the potential damage of evil. But it also seems conceivable to me that that lessens the good of free will as well, and that the ability to do wrong is directly proportionate to the value of goodness chosen. So that it would seem that if evil was less potent in this world, then probably the goodness would also be less potent. That makes sense.
Yeah, that's actually really interesting. Because I was thinking as you would say that God would not put a lesser good. He would not prioritize a lesser good over a greater good. And that kind of speaks almost to God's thoughts, where you have to make a value judgment over how much free will to allow, or how much capacity for humans to allow, and how much evil that would necessarily entail. And if that result is worth it, why do you think God created man if these very difficult things and really terrible realities came to be? What was God's purpose in creating man?
I do believe that God is an artist. You cannot look at the sky without thinking that that's the case. If you believe in creationism, at least.
It's incredibly beautiful no matter your worldview. So you can look at the stars and really get the same feeling you get from that than you get from a beautiful piece of art. So I get that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know that I have a good answer as to why he created mankind, other than believing that he loves creating. And that as much as we can look at the evil in the world, there is so much beauty in a human being. I have six children, they are incredible human beings. They're beautiful. Not all the time. Is the beauty coming through? But man, that beauty does come through on each and every one of them at times, and they are truly good. When a human being is doing what's right, man, they are an incredible creation. I have a lovely wife, and she is beautiful. The stars above are beautiful, and I look at my wife, and she is beautiful as well. So that's a kind of random argument for the existence of God.
the argument from beauty.
Yeah, the argument from beauty. Okay. But not only that, but I'm actually saying the same thing. That the stars above and my wife actually share something, there is this part of reality that is shared by all these different things. So there's an essence of beauty. So I'm a Platonist as well, I'm a realist about universals, that there really is this universal thing called beauty. That's a good argument to throw in the mix.
It's an interesting one for sure. I've heard very, very general arguments similar to that. They're generally not used in like a philosophical debate or a philosophical paper or anything, but I have used that, or I have heard that being used before, where people simply, look out the window and they ask, how can anybody not believe in God? And I do think beauty is something that is so incredibly moving. It speaks to our core in ways that very few other things do. And I think that can awaken kind of a spiritual feeling that religion has access to, or spirituality has access to religion in that way. So yeah, that's a very, very interesting thing to really look at. I am curious, what is your favorite argument against the existence of God, if you have one? Or what are the best ones, you think, if you think any of them have more value than others?
Well, I would say they're all versions of the problem of evil. The most difficult ones are all just one of the versions of the problems of evil. Here's one that I don't hear other people talk about that I think is definitely an attack for young earth creationism. And I would say that's the argument from sexual perversion, when you see Christian leaders who turns out that behind the scenes, they've been living these lives where they're all kinds of, they got 50 sex slaves in other countries that they visit regularly and things like that. That would be that's really hard on Christianity. Harm the witness of Christianity. If naturalistic evolution were true, you would expect nature to select for sexual predators. That would be more likely. So when you see sexual predation in the church, that's a serious attack upon Christianity. And if Christianity is serious about getting its witness together, it's got to get a handle on that.
Yeah, I mean those heinous actions have driven a lot of people away from the church. You know, not only victims, but just witnesses, or even people who hear about it. And it's hard to say it's not warranted. Especially if you are a victim, given what we know about the nature of things like PTSD and things like that, it would totally be understandable for, you know, a victim to just alienate themselves from anything that kind of brings up those memories, which you can view as unfortunate, depending on your persuasion, because it's obviously the case that the overwhelming majority of, you know, religious people of all faiths are not in favor of something like that and are just as appalled as anybody else. So yeah, that's definitely a, you know, you can make so many versions of the problem of evil just because evil is so pervasive and it disgusts us so much. One I don't hear very often that I actually heard from Alex O'Connor, if you're familiar with him. He's kind of a younger, kind of atheist philosopher.
Two or three times. I haven't spent much time listening to him, but I have heard him some.
Yeah, he's a very, very interesting guy. And he's really what inspired a lot of, I think, edgy internet atheists to kind of grow up and, you know, kind of approach the topic seriously, or, you know, stop approaching it at all. But at least that's the vibe I got from it. He doesn't explicitly say that, but he brings up the problem of animal suffering, and not just from like factory farms and things like that, but just in the natural world. You know, these are beings that we know have the capacity to suffer. We don't really know to what extent, but we know that they have the capacity to suffer. And that's rarely considered, because if you really think about the suffering laid in on animals, it's at the very least comparable to that of humans. Now, again, they might not have the full capacity to understand suffering, but the magnitude to which they experience it, I think we can say, is fundamentally greater. Humans usually don't have to worry about predators. And things like that, but virtually every other animal does. And it's something that we don't even really think of, because we don't, when we live our lives, we if we see an animal, it's either a pest or it's either a glorious moment. Like, look at that cute dog, or, you know, this really cool lizard that my friend has, and stuff like that. But have you heard that brought up before, and kind of what do you think of it?
I heard a segment from him about that. I enjoy listening to Dr. Michael Humer.
Okay.
With him at all, but I got into him for political reasons. But he likes to dabble in a lot of things, and he is a vegan, and so he pushes that philosophy. I also become friends with Rupert McCollum on Facebook. There, I really like him. He's probably one of my favorite atheist friends that I have. He's a good guy to talk to. But yeah, and this issue matters a lot to him. I have a lot of issues with claims about animal consciousness that to me seem based on what I consider to be poor philosophy as opposed to science. Now, I'm a young Earth creationist, so a lot of people say, well, you're nuts off the bat. I'm skeptical of a lot of the claims I hear about animals and their conscious experience. It seems like it's a pretty big leap to say what an animal is thinking. It may be true. I'm not saying it isn't true, but it's a really big jump to say I know what a dog's thinking, or I know what a cow's thinking. Now, if I was fully invested in naturalistic evolution, then I would say, consciousness comes from material world. Well, at least most of my evolutionist friends are also physicalists, and they believe that the mind is entirely physical. There's a very interesting discussion I just listened to the other day between Michael Humer and Graham Oppy. If you're familiar with those two, they're both atheists. And so that's one thing I really like about Michael Humer. I agree with him on a lot of things, and he has, I'll say, odd takes for an atheist. Not too many atheists I know believe in a soul.
I saw you post that, and I was like, and I thought it was a Christian and an atheist, and I actually clicked on it to listen to it a bit. I'm like, wait, I know this guy. This guy's an atheist. Like,
and honestly, I think that that's a real tough point for naturalists. I don't think when you list out the arguments for the immateriality of the mind, I don't think there are good arguments for physicalism. And most of the animal rights philosophy that I see pushed assumes physicalism of the mind.
Yeah.
I don't believe in the physicalism of the mind. And I don't think, and I really think that most people I know who are physicalists who have studied the philosophy would agree, okay, well, our position is not really that strong here. We're going to have to bite the bullet on this one, as opposed to this is a strength of our philosophy, but to say this is an area of our philosophy that does appear weak. And, I have to believe in it for other reasons than that it makes sense philosophically. Sure. And admittedly, there are points in my Christian faith that I say, that one sounds good. But this part over here sounds a lot better than the part. And so there's a cumulative weighing of a philosophy. I haven't found any philosophy that I thought answered all the questions. Mine certainly doesn't. But part of philosophy is saying, well, what's the best option that's out there?
Right.
So all that to get back to the question of animal suffering, I'm skeptical that animals suffer in the same way that human beings do.
Yeah, I mean, most of the, you said it, you didn't really think it was scientific. And I have to admit that, I don't think a lot of it is either. You and I both know when a dog is suffering, but we can't quantify that in any way. And that simple observation is, it's not repeatable for a lot of ethical reasons, but it's also not repeatable kind of fundamentally, because it's simply an experience, and experiences are difficult to replicate in the truest sense of replication. So I get that entirely. And I do think a big wing of kind of the animal rights movement is kind of basing their idea of animal suffering on kind of anecdotal observation. That's not to say that there aren't more scientific studies into animal suffering. There are, but overall, I do think we're kind of on shaky empirical ground when it comes to that. And part of that is just the nature of consciousness. We can't plug our minds into the mind of a dog. Maybe one day we will, but it's definitely a difficult topic. I mean, I'm basically your typical meat eater who tries to mitigate animal products when it's convenient. So I'm definitely not one of these people, but you brought up physicalism, and I do think animal rights kind of necessarily entails physicalism. I mean, maybe not, but most of the voices that you hear from this community really do sound an awful lot like physicalists. Why is it that you don't, what problems do you have with physicalism?
Now I'm trying to remember what the list that I read was really good. Right now, I'm imagining a purple unicorn dancing around the corner of my office.
Okay.
Are you able to imagine such a thing in your office or wherever you are at the moment? Purple unicorn?
Yeah, I can imagine it.
Okay. Do you think the unicorn is in your head right now?
No.
Okay. Then it seems to rule out physicalism.
How so?
So I actually have this vision, and it's not physical. I can't touch it, can't feel it. It's not what we would call physical. There's this part of experience that isn't physical.
So I'm not I'm not super well versed on the defenses of physicalism. When I first heard of this, a lot of different things, these things were ascribed to me by Christians I was debating, which is fine. I mean, if you sound to the T like something and somebody's like, oh, well, that belief system, which is called the yada yada, is faulty because this, that, or the other thing. Not angry or bitter about it, but all that to say, I'm just not, I'm not in the position to defend the philosophy as a whole. But what I will say is that these processes that result in me thinking of a purple unicorn are physical forces. And the experience itself is entirely predicated on the physical force. Like I can bring my thoughts to life in some way. I can think about something stressful and my heart rate will go up, and I can control that, which kind of speaks to thoughts having some level of, at least some level of physical reality. Now they are completely subjective, and in some sense they only exist within the mind, but I think the common objection to that would be that these are entirely predicated on physical forces, that we can really track the navigation of a thought through the brain with modern technology. But mere thoughts existing, I don't know how you can say that
experience. So you think that there's some sort of purple unicorn chemical reaction that goes on in the brain.
To oversimplify, yeah.
I mean, that'd be silly.
Right, yeah. But yes, overall, I think that's a fair summation that it likely boils down to biochemistry.
Yeah. But the picture of the unicorn, do you think that the picture or your sensation, so what the term would be qualia that the philosophers use, and I'm not real comfortable with that because I haven't read a whole lot about it. One example of qualia would be C.S. Lewis says that a fish doesn't know what it feels like to be wet because he always is wet.
Sure.
But a human being knows what it's like to be wet. And qualia is the state of being like or to be like. What do you think wetness is?
This just brings me back to that the entire political debate over whether or not water is wet and the media literally running amok over just a bizarre statement that the president uttered. But I guess wetness is just feeling water. It's the sensation of water on sensory receptors.
Yeah. So it would seem then that when you're on the physicalist view, wetness then is just what can I say? It's just your personal I'm butchering this. Wetness is your personal biochemical reaction to what happens when you feel water on your skin. There's a certain reaction in the brain that occurs.
Sure.
This is really disappointing. I'm disappointing myself because I read up on this and I had good arguments 4 or 5 months ago, but my memory falls apart. Why I came to the position that I held, and that's sad.
I will give you this, that the thought experiment of a purple unicorn, there is something there where there is we do know the brain, whether you're a Christian or somebody who's an atheist or anything in between, we do know that biochemical reactions in the brain do cause differences in thoughts and behaviors, moods, and things like that.
To say that the brain is intertwined with the mind, and in some sense, it's the mind's dependent on the brain.
Right. So
everybody accepts that. Most everybody accepts that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's possible to deny it, but yeah. All that to say, it does make me ponder. What the nature of a thought actually is this thing that's external to the brain, or is it it is an interesting point to bring up that a thought, really, can you really describe it as physical? I don't know, maybe not. It strikes me that my intuition is saying probably not, but again, I'm not an individual who it delves into the philosophy of physicalism to the point where I can, defend it and give it its due credit, whatever credit it has.
I was talking to a friend about this, and one of the other points is that how can something physical be about something else?
I guess I'm not following.
Yeah. So yeah, and maybe we could just talk about this sometime after I do a little bit more reading back on my notes. I went over this. I think it was November. I read into the. I get into pads or whatever. I'll read up on one topic for a whole bunch for a month or so, and then okay, on to the next one. And this one was really interesting. But
yeah, no. I think a lot of us do that, where we just obsess over one thing for 6 weeks and then never touch it again. But
yeah.
But the last thing I kind of want to ask you about before we cut this off here is, what is your understanding of hell? Because I know there's real varied understandings of what it is, from the most traditional fire and brimstone, eternal burning and torture, to more nuanced versions of, oh, it's just a separation from God and you pretty much just stop existing. Where do you fall in that? And why do you think people end up in the state of hell if you do believe in that as a real thing?
Yeah. So that's a good question, good deep question. I tend to follow C.S. Lewis on this issue. There are three main views that people will talk about. One is that eternal conscious torment, and that's the one that is pretty, you make the best argument from the Bible from, that people are punished in this burning, this sensation of fire. And that's say the most common Christian belief, at least since the 4th century, when you read church history. The second view is called annihilationism, and that means that perhaps people are punished for a period and then they cease to exist. There are some biblical passages that tend to that view. And then the third view is called universalism, which most evangelicals would reject as a heresy. And that's the belief that all human beings will eventually be saved after some period of punishment, that they will all end up in heaven. I think it's very difficult to make a case from the Bible for that view. That's largely based on philosophical grounds. Now we'll make a case that if God is love, then that seems to work out best. And they'll make philosophical arguments from the Bible for that position. C.S. Lewis said that all three have some sort of, C.S. Lewis said he doesn't know, but that all three, he can picture a reality where all three have some sort of view. And his book, The Great Divorce, he outlines this. He said basically that the Bible says that God desires all human beings to be saved. Now, I want to say very clearly that, you know, Jesus' words about hell aren't a pretty picture. That Jesus talks about a place of burning and destruction, and he talks about it in Revelation as well. I'd also say that hell needs to be taken very seriously if you're a Christian, and that it's something to that's very important. Jesus' teachings, one might classify as part of Old Testament prophetic literature. And when prophets in the Old Testament talk about destruction, they often intentionally use hyperbole in the destruction. So I personally hope it's not as bad as it sounds. It might very well be. I think there's reason to hope that there may be some hyperbole at work in the New Testament descriptions. But anyhow, C.S. Lewis talks about the place where God is reaching out to man, and some men will turn to God and be redeemed. Some men will turn away from God and yet not totally. And so they will forever be in a state where they reject God. And that this would be the equivalent of the eternal conscious torment view. And he said other men will reject God and be able to reject existence as well, and will cease to exist. So C.S. Lewis theorizes, and he would have said, I'm just making this stuff up, I'm not sure, it just sounds good, that all three might exist depending on which the choice that the human free will continues to make after death.
So there's a possibility of all these examples of hell actually existing, but
our ongoing choice determines which one we live in.
That choice after death?
It would be an ongoing choice that is made.
Okay.
So it would be the same place, but it would have a different effect on them.
Okay. Interesting. You know, C.S. Lewis has long been one of my favorite authors, but for the longest time, he was one of my least favorite apologists. Up until recently, at a very narrow view of the moral argument, I found it to be, and even now, I find alternative explanations for the existence of morality to be, have greater weight and seem more reasonable. But regardless, the more and more I actually look into Lewis's apologetics rather than just hearing quotes or reading excerpts, the more and more I have a all-around respect for the man. Not only was he a brilliant author, but he took his work very seriously, and a lot of it is really, basically all of his creative work is an inspiration from his faith. And his biography, Surprised by Joy, is, you know, it's a very surprising look into his life. But all that aside, do you think, you are a Christian, so you view hell as necessary or at least reasonable and just, or do you find yourself to grapple with the idea that people you love and care about may find themselves in hell, whatever version of it?
Sure. So I actually do believe that evil is really evil and you deserve to be punished for your evil, the evil that you commit. I believe that a just case for hell could be made or is made. I do believe that a punishment has to fit the crime to be just.
Right.
So I struggle with the claim that eternal hell is a just punishment for the crime.
It strikes me as difficult to have eternal punishment for a finite crime. I mean, there are greater and lesser crimes. Is a Christian who commits multiple murders worse than, you know, an atheist who otherwise lives a very moral life, but, you know, rejects Christianity? That to me has always been hard to grapple, but continue.
I understand. One point that I think is important when you're thinking about that is we often don't realize the consequences of our evil, even our small evils.
Sure.
One example, you know, a father uses pornography, his 12-year-old son gets a hold of it, and it spirals, and then he's raping someone. And our sins, when we, our small sins, we think 7 generations later might result in murder or rape or something that's a large sin, that we would call a large sin. So in some senses, any sin is likely to have result in unlimited evil. So I think that there's a reasonable basis to think our concept of what's a just punishment for sin might be very undervalued or very understated.
I suppose that would still be finite. However greater the effect is than we initially think.
So that's a good question. And yeah. I'm not sure if that's the case. I would say I'm not sure that that's the case.
I just mean, since humans are only going to be around for so long, no matter the worldview you have,
So let's say, you know, Hitler murders somebody, one person. Now, we could say, well, it's just for Hitler murdered, you know, to receive exactly what he had done. But at the same time, that doesn't solve the issue. He doesn't unmurder someone if he's punished.
Yeah.
One could say, well, you know, murdering him simply isn't enough. That's not just. It's true in some senses that any act of evil is unlimited evil itself, because even the punishment doesn't restore. If the eternal conscious torment is true, and part of me thinks it is, that it's because we've tended to forget the reality that evil is really bad. It's really evil, and it's in some ways it can be punished, but in other ways, no punishment is adequate for what's done.
That's an interesting point. I hadn't really pondered kind of the everlasting magnification of one particular act of evil, especially when the punishment may itself be evil or may inspire evil or something like that. But how would you view, like, simply a non-believer who, nobody's sinless under the Christian worldview, but, you know.
Yeah, so some people think that someone who says, I don't believe in Jesus, is committing some additional sin that is earning them damnation.
And it seems to be unforgivable.
I don't take that view. I can think of several scriptures that seem to undermine that claim.
Okay.
I don't think that that's the case. I think that, that the punishment for an unbeliever is for the sins he committed, not his unbelief.
Okay. That's interesting. I've heard a few people say similar things, that, you know, punishment is really for sin. And it's not necessarily tied to belief or faith, which is interesting, but I don't know how that's squared with kind of the Protestant view that it's faith alone that gets you into heaven.
Yeah. Well, So that would be kind of a way of speaking of faith, but that wouldn't really be. I don't think the Protestant claim is that. Now there probably are some Protestants who claim that it's the sin of unbelief that is ultimately what damns. But no, I don't see that as being scriptural. And to me, it doesn't make sense philosophically either.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm pulling straight from Luther on that one, but not everybody follows him, so understandable.
Yeah, I mean, being a Wesleyan Arminian, I'm kind of the opposite side of Protestantism from Calvin and Luther. And
sure.
Yeah,
that's interesting. I'm going to actually look a little more into the Church of Nazarene, because I think a lot of what you stated is outside of what I've generally heard from a lot of Christians who are, you know, mainline Protestants or Catholics or I don't know many Eastern Orthodox followers, but that's also a...
They're very interesting. I don't know too many of them either, but they're all very interesting, the ones that I know.
Yeah, it's more of an Eastern European thing, hence the name Eastern Orthodox. But
yeah. I'll give you a brief Church of Nazarene history. It's basically a branch off of Methodism. So Luther and Calvin split off in the 1530s, created, or, well, Luther branched off and Calvin shortly followed. In Germany, they started what was called Protestantism, but then up in England, the Church of England, King Henry, he didn't like the Pope.
Right.
So he started his own church, and that's the Church of England.
Right.
Methodism is a branch off of the Church of England. And then around 1900, basically, the Church of the Nazarene, there's many splinter groups off of Methodism, but there was a group of churches that basically thought that the Methodists had become wishy-washy around them and wanted more of a pure Methodism. And so you could say that the Church of the Nazarene is a descendant of Methodism.
Okay.
At one point, thought the group had abandoned some of its original beliefs. There are other groups that are very similar. The Wesleyans, very similar to the Salvation Army, and those are other denominations that are close by theologically.
Interesting. Well, I think we'll end it on that, and that'll give me some extra things to look into. As I said, you brought up some takes from the Christian perspective that I really haven't heard before, or at least have really only heard bits and pieces of. So I want to thank you for coming on. I really appreciate it. This has been really enlightening and enjoyable.
Thanks for letting me talk. I really enjoyed talking about this stuff, and you're very pleasant to be with. I'd like to do it again in other ways, maybe.
Yeah, definitely. I would love to do that. So I just want to thank everybody for tuning into the Everyday People podcast, and we will see you with the next one.